Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. These days, political polarization is on the rise as support for democracy declines in the U.S. and around the world. Why is it so hard for us to get along, and what can we do about it? We talked with social psychologist and author Jonathan Haidt about the moral foundations of politics and how our kids can play their way to a better democracy. Our guest host for today's interview is Jenna Spinelli, host of the Democracy Works podcast produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State.
John, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jenna.
So, John, you have written, and we say on this podcast all the time that democracy is hard work. It's not natural. It's not easy. And I think you are perhaps uniquely qualified to help us understand why that is.
Okay. Well, let's give it a try.
Yeah.
So I'm a social psychologist, and I study morality. And I always try to put everything in both an evolutionary context and a cultural context. And so the way I like to approach the problem is to say, well, how do humans tend to live politically? And as far as I can tell, there are two main ways. There are two ways that are really, really stable and widely found. And so one is egalitarian hunter-gatherers. This is the way all of our ancestors lived for hundreds of thousands or millions of years, depending on how you count it. Before they get settled, before there's agriculture, this is the way all societies are. And then once you take up agriculture, you get hierarchy, and pretty quickly you get something like feudalism. And it emerges on multiple continents, and you know it's really clear in Japan. And so these two ways of living really fit with our psychology. And then there are a bunch of other ways that have been tried, you know, communism, communes, democracy. And these ways tend to be very short-lived. They tend to be very unstable. In fact, here's a wonderful quote from our founding fathers. This is from the Madison Federalist 10. Here he's speaking of direct democracies. He says, "Hence it is that such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths." So democracy is not natural. It's not stable. Our founding fathers didn't want it. So democracy is not really such a great thing. What is great is that the people can kick out the government if they don't like it. And that was what our founding fathers were really committed to. And so they gave us a republic with democratic features. And, you know, look, I'm not a political scientist or an historian. I'm sure I'm getting some details wrong here. But the big picture is that in the 20th century, we developed this obsession with democracy. And I think it's because we fought a war to defend democracy in World War I. And then we did it again in World War II. And we all got kind of fooled into thinking that democracy is the greatest thing in the world. And then in the 1990s, when the Soviet Union collapses, it was clear that democracy won and there is no alternative. And it's the end of history in every country as it develops is going to become a free market liberal democracy just like us. And we were wrong. We were fooled. Democracy is a lot harder, a lot less stable. And now it's clear we took it for granted, and it's a lot harder than we thought.
Right. So are there things about the way we're wired as people that make it so hard or so kind of difficult to carry out in practice?
Yeah. So the founding fathers, in addition to being great historians, they were also really good psychologists. So they knew that we're passionate creatures, that we tend not to be very good at reasoning as individuals. And this is where my own work comes in. The reason I got into this aspect of political theory is because I study moral psychology, and my research basically led me to the view of David Hume that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. So Hume was basically disagreeing with the long rationalist tradition in philosophy, saying all you people who think like, oh, humans are such great reasoners and we're rational and that's our God-given ability, you're just completely wrong. Have you ever looked at a person? Do you relate to any people? We're not like that. And the founding fathers knew that. And so that's why you don't want to have something that's too democratic, because especially when there are hard times, somebody's going to come along and tell you, the reason for our troubles is them. They're the reason. And it's really easy to rally people to hate them and then attack them and kill them. So the founding fathers knew that. And as again, I'm not an historian, but it seems as though a lot of the reforms in the progressive era made America more democratic. And some of them may have kind of backfired. And many people will look at the 2016 election and see, in many ways, the fulfillment of the Founding Fathers' worst nightmares, as they expressed in the Federalist Papers.
But, you know, even though you kind of started to touch a little bit on this kind of idea of, you know, we're not as rational as we think, and even though we all kind of understand that democracy is so hard, it doesn't really stop us from trying to practice it, right? We vote and we support the free press and we go out and organize or demonstrate, some of us. So what motivates people to do those types of things, even in the face of knowing that it is hard and it is, you know, all the things we were talking about earlier?
You know, we talk about the American experiment. And what it really was, as I understand it, was an experiment in self-government. Because in 1776, there were not a lot of examples, or I think there were none, of people self-governing. It was always either a monarch of some sort or a dictator. And I believe they wrote a lot about the need for education. They believed a lot in public education. You have to educate people for democracy. You have to cultivate virtues for democracy. And then there are institutions, respect for the courts, rule of law. And so if you have all these things, then it's kind of like a playing field on which people can pursue their interests, what they call the pursuit of happiness. Happiness didn't mean joy. It meant the pursuit of a well-ordered life in which you are successful and you like your life. It was your condition, your state is what happiness meant. And so people Americans have long been known for being individualists. And de Tocqueville noted how we individualists come together very quickly and easily to solve problems. That was what he noted was really unique about us. So we've always been a democratic people in that sense, ready to take things into our own hands, solve problems. And America in the 20th century, we certainly see many cases of activism that were like that and that worked. Of course, taking things into your own hands can also lead to riots and violence. But we're not a subjugated people. We're a free people. And, our political behavior shows that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking specifically about the way that we've organized ourselves into political parties here in the U.S., your book, The Righteous Mind, does a great job of going through several moral foundations that separate, you know, what conservatives value versus what liberals value. Can you kind of walk us through what those are and how the parties differ in that way?
Sure. So the Founding Fathers didn't want political parties. But, of course, as soon as the Constitution was proposed, there was one saying yes and one saying no. The worst number of political parties to have in a country is one. But the second worst number is two, because we evolved for tribal warfare. We evolved to do us versus them. And research shows that if you simply have three combatants, then the hatred of each for the other is much less. Two is the optimum number to really bring out our ability to organize in hatred of our enemies. Now, in the past, as far as I can tell, there never was, until the 1990s, we've never had two parties organized almost entirely by psychological type. It was always by material interests or region or other things. Now, obviously, a regional split is pretty dangerous. That's not a good split. But when you're organized by material interests and industry, you can compromise. You can do horse trading. What happened, though, in the 1980s and 90s in the United States is that we had, for a variety of historical reasons, there were conservative Democrats in the South especially, and there were liberal Republicans in the Northeast and Northwest. So both parties were kind of incoherent psychologically, and there was a lot of overlap in terms of left-right. And so you could have a lot of compromise and bipartisan teams. And so in some ways, those were very good days, at least if you look at Congress and our ability to compromise. And this all happens after World War II, which is the greatest spur to cooperation in American history. Other than the Revolutionary War, perhaps. I just saw Hamilton. It was absolutely wonderful. So on to the psychology. So my own research began by looking at how morality varies around the world. And my colleagues and I came up with a theory called moral foundations theory, based in part on the work of Richard Schwader, an anthropologist at the University of Chicago. And what we did is we said, what are the taste buds of the moral sense? What are the the features, the intuitions that you find all over the world. And so the list we came up with by looking at anthropology and evolution, the five really clear matches were, the first is care versus harm. And that comes right out of the attachment system. We're mammals. We care for our young. We're sensitive to harm. The second is fairness versus cheating. And there's work on reciprocal altruism, and every society has reciprocity. And the third is loyalty versus betrayal. We do coalitional psychology. The fourth is authority versus subversion. We're primates. We have deep, deep hierarchical psychology. We show deference the same way that other primates do. And the last of the original five is called sanctity versus degradation. This is something no other animal has, but we have this emotion of disgust. We see contamination. If A touches B and B touches C, then C takes on the properties of A. We have all kinds of magical beliefs. And you see this in religious practice, sacred objects. A lot of moral regulation is about who can touch what, when, and with what purification rituals beforehand. So those are the five original ones. There's a bunch more. We talk now about liberty versus oppression. I think property or possession is one. All right. I'm sorry this is such a long answer.
No, it's okay.
But to bring it now finally back to politics. So we developed the theory for looking at cross-national differences. But it turns out in the 1990s and early 2000s, as I was doing that work, it began to be clear that left and right in America were becoming like two different countries. They each had their own American history textbook, their own economics textbook, their own climate science textbook, their own U.S. Constitution. So what we found empirically is that people on the left in the United States, but we find this in most other countries we look at too, they tend to build their moral world on care, the care foundation, and then a version of fairness, which emphasizes equality. Those are the two main ones. People on the right, they have those concerns. They certainly love their children and their dogs, but their political theories, their social understandings are not based primarily on a sense of compassion for suffering. They're based more on a sense of fairness as just desert, as proportionality. Do the crime, do the time. And then conservatives also build a lot more on group loyalty, all the way out to nationalism, respect for authority, God and country, respect your parents, and a sense of sanctity or purity, especially the social conservatives, the Christian conservatives. Libertarians are different. Libertarians are actually low on everything except for liberty. They really, really value liberty. And so what we got beginning once Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act, and that sets in motion a set of tectonic changes whereby the Southern conservative Democrats begin shifting over to the Republican Party, just as President Johnson had predicted. And then the liberal Republicans start getting either primaried or pushed out. So only by the 1990s do we get a perfect sorting where we have two parties, and anyone who's psychologically disposed to leftism or progressivism is now a Democrat, and anyone psychologically predisposed to conservatism or traditionalism or stability or order is now a Republican. And that means that the people on the other side really are odious. They really are different from us. It's not just that they have different material interests where we could compromise. No. Those people, and you can go through the list of the virtues that they don't have that your side does. And that's part of the reason why when you look at cross-partisan hatred, the degree to which people on both sides hate each other, it was pretty low in the 70s. I mean, the graphs from ANES, the American National Election Survey, show not much hatred. I mean, we didn't like people on the other side, but we didn't hate them. And we didn't mind so much if our children married someone from the other party. And since then, the hatred for the other side and the unwillingness to have your kids marry the other side has just gone up and up and up, and especially in the 2000s. And that's where we are today.
You're listening to Take Note on WPSU. If you're just joining us, we're talking with social psychologist and author Jonathan Haidt. In his 2012 book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, Haidt writes about the metaphor of the elephant and the rider.
So as I was going through The Righteous Mind, I wrote that 2019, that it's like the elephants on steroids.
That's right. No, that's right.
Yeah. So can you explain to us what that mm-hmm. Metaphor means and how it relates to how we, mm-hmm. we view each other in a democracy?
Sure. So my first book was called The Happiness Hypothesis. Oh, my God. Why am I forgetting the subtitle? You know, it's about ancient wisdom and modern truth. I surveyed the wisdom literatures of every society I could find, extracted their psychological claims, and every society that left us a wisdom literature observed that people are often torn, they're divided internally. And how do you represent this? Given the psychology that I was reading and the research I was doing, the metaphor that I offered was a small boy sitting on the back of a giant elephant. And so the idea is we do engage in reason. We do engage in language-based thinking that is subject to the laws of logic. And the elephant represents the other 99% of the things going on in your mind, almost all of which are automatic and out of awareness. The job of the writer is not really in charge. The writer is really more of, as Hume said, a servant or a press secretary is a good mm-hmm. metaphor, of the emotions. You see this in politics. You know, we can justify anything our side wants, and then next year, you know, something flips and we justify the opposite. So if you think about it as this delicate balance between what we can articulate with our reasons and what we really want with our tribal emotions, and then you think of a healthy political order in which there are some restraints on what you can say, and you can't say things that are just obviously untrue. They have to be at least justifiable. And then just for fun, let's just make everyone really, really connected instantly to everyone else and able to respond to everyone else right away. And let's do this maybe around 2006, 2007. We'll start it. We'll call it Facebook. And then we'll have a lot of other platforms that do this. And let's also add a lot of video. Let's give everyone a video camera in their pocket so that everyone gets to take videos of the most outrageous things that people on the other side are doing and saying. And we'll give everyone a way that they can put into this sort of the social stream the most shocking, horrifying, outrage-inducing videos they can come up with. What happens to that delicate balance? It goes completely haywire in countries all around the world. And this is the main reason, I think, why it seems as though democracy is in big trouble and things are falling apart. There are a lot of trends. There's globalization, inequality. There are a lot of trends. But the sudden linking of everyone to everyone and with materials that outrage the elephant in the space of about 5 or 10 years, I think, is the reason why things are really going to hell.
Yeah, I mean, which is kind of ironic because you think about it. These tools on their face should be the most democratizing things out there.
So a lot of it depends on your view of human nature. And so this is one of the main things. So I started off on the left, and I started writing The Righteous Mind in order to help the Democrats win because I couldn't stand it. They had no idea. Like Al Gore and John Kerry, they had no idea how to talk about American morality. And so I began reading conservative mm-hmm. writings in order to understand it. And so I learned a lot about conservatism and came to have tremendous respect for the philosophical tradition, not for the Republican Party, but for the conservative philosophical tradition.
I see a lot, I hear a lot of calls for restoring civility. I see that hashtag mm-hmm. on Twitter all the time. What do you make of that? Is that the right approach given where things are and how
well,
we're
yeah,
wired?
It's absolutely the right approach that we need to restore civility, but it's the wrong approach to thinking, hey, let's all just say we should restore civility and let's take a pledge. Let's sign a pledge. You know, because what we really mean by civility is you guys need to be more civil. You guys need to stop doing what you're doing. And so anything that rewards call-out culture, anything that gives you prestige for shaming and humiliating others, for forwarding false or even true outrage materials, as long as the reward systems, the prestige economy does that, we're all just going to be continuing to choke on outrage. So it's going to take changing the algorithms somehow to reward. So I think the word for 2019 should be nuance. That's my favorite mm-hmm. word now. And now that Twitter doubled its character length, whatever, a couple years ago, now it's actually possible, even on Twitter, to sometimes say, I think you're right about X, but I disagree on Y. And so if there was a way to reward nuance and to punish oversimplification or people who are frequent outragers, that would help.
Right. And this ties to some of your work in your latest book, The Coddling of the American Mind. We've seen also a decline in support for democracy. As the generations go down, you can follow the graph on down. It's currently about 30% for millennials. There's no research that I know of to date on Gen Z. But, you know, what do you think accounts for some of these changing attitudes? And from your work that you've done on Gen Z, what do you think we're likely to see from them moving forward?
So first, on the very steep decline in support for democracy, I think the 30% figure is people who say it is essential to live in a democracy. So it's not that only 30% of millennials support it. It's that only 30%
correct.
Of millennials give extreme support. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what you have to always do whenever you look at a change is you don't just say, what's wrong with them? Why do those millennials do that? What you have to also do is you have to say, well, what about the people 50 years ago? What was wrong with them? Why did they say 90% say it had? Well, you know, if you just went through World War I, World War II, the Cold War against, you know, a nuclear threat, you know, and the free world won, the free world. So that steep decline, I think, reflects much more the fact that people who were raised in the 20th century, as the baby boomers were, and Gen X, but not millennials so much, people who were raised in the heyday of fighting fascism, fighting communism, and the heyday of the American government's effectiveness. My God, the interstate highway system, putting a man on the moon, staring down, you know, all these foreign enemies. I mean, the American system was the envy of the world in the mid to late 20th century. So we all thought, again, democracy is fantastic. It's the winning formula. It's vital to live in a democracy. But the rap on democracies has always been that they tend to be weak, inconsistent, driven by passion. Well, you know, any developing country that looks at America and looks at China and says, what kind of government do we want? I mean, they'd be crazy to take our form, at least in what they see now. Xi Jinping's authoritarian we can call it authoritarian capitalism, is delivering the goods, delivering growth, and giving stability. So if you're growing up now as in America, you're not exactly going to be pro-China. But if someone asks you, is it absolutely essential to live in a democracy, like why would you say yes?
Right, or you just don't have that frame of reference. You don't maybe have the historical background as well. You talk a lot about the decline of civics education. And kind of on that point of education, I know you've also written about the relationship between free play and democracy, which
that's
isn't
right,
one
yeah.
that you know people might make kind of readily.
No, that's right.
So what does that look like in your mind?
Yeah. So I co-wrote this book, The Coddling of the American Mind, with my friend Greg Lukianoff. And we're trying to understand why is it that campus culture changed so quickly between 2014 and 2017? Not everywhere, but at the elite schools, especially in the Northeast, there's a new culture of safetyism in which students who, you know, the millennials who were college students in the early 2000s, the last of them graduated around 2015 or so, 2016. But the millennials, you know, if someone was coming to campus to give a talk that they didn't like, they would not go to the talk, or maybe they'd go and argue. But beginning in 2014, 2015, we started seeing a huge rise of protests, disinvitation efforts, justified by the claim that if this person speaks, it will be traumatizing, that we students are so fragile, so easily hurt by dangerous ideas, that the administration must protect us. And so there's an enormous rise of self-perceived fragility and a lack of toughness, and people started commenting on how Gen Z, the kids born in 1996 or later, Gen Z are not able to solve basic problems for themselves. They expect adults to fix things if they're wrong. They're not self-reliant. They do not have the virtues of liberty that the Founding Fathers thought and that de Tocqueville praised in us. So in our book, we go into six reasons why this new culture came about so quickly. But the biggest one, the biggest single one, I believe, is that kids in America always were let out at the age of six. If you were born before 1982, if you're Gen X or older, you were let out in first grade. And you'd go outside and you'd play. And in play groups, there's a lot of research on play. In play, you learn to cooperate. You learn to set rules. You learn what to do when someone seems to have broken the rules. How do we adjudicate this? If some kids are really young, well, how can we incorporate them in play? We'll take it easy on them. So this is how you learn social skills, is play, free play. And it has to be unsupervised. If there's an adult there to settle disputes, you learn nothing. No, wait a second. You learn how to appeal to adults. And so Gen Z is the first generation in American history that was deprived of childhood. we freaked out in the 90s and thought, even though the crime rate was plummeting, and actually the crime wave ended in the 90s, Americans began to think, because of we were frightened out of our minds by the media, that if we ever take our eyes off our kids outside, they will be abducted. And so in the 90s, we stopped letting kids out. And by the early 2000s, nobody had seen a child outside unsupervised in 10 years. And so we have a whole generation, beginning with kids born in 1996, who didn't get to practice. They didn't get thousands and thousands of hours of practice of free play in mixed age groups where they had to set the rules and resolve disputes. This, we believe, is they simply did not learn the skills of democracy. Democracy requires setting rules, enforcing rules, changing rules, compromise, working it out. And so I think democracy, our democracy is in real danger now. But when Gen Z becomes more politically active, you know, so in the 2030s, when they'll be the largest group, let's say, I think our ability to govern ourselves will be much harder.
What can people do, or you know, what's your advice to concerned small D Democrats out there for how to right the ship, so to speak?
So I think we have to break it up into a couple of levels. So the first thing is we have to give kids back childhood to create more resilient kids. And this isn't – the argument here isn't, oh, if you love democracy. The argument is, oh, if you love your children. I mean, the rates of anxiety and depression are skyrocketing, especially for girls. So there is an urgent national health emergency that we have to stop overprotecting kids. We have to let them develop skills of independence. So that will pay off in about 30 years. If we could start doing that tomorrow, in 30 or 40 years, our democracy would be better. So that's one thing we have to start doing. Secondly, I think we have to educate kids as if democracy was fragile and as if it mattered. And so that means we have to be teaching skills of democratic engagement. In terms of teaching skills of interaction, I think that high school should be teaching politics in a very different way. That is, teachers and social studies teachers in particular tend to be on the left. They either don't teach anything about conservatism or some of them let their politics intrude. And I think we should be teaching great respect for the long philosophical traditions of left and right, and then teaching skills of democratic discourse. But all of this is at the individual level. That has to be done. But ultimately, the heavy lift is going to be done at the systemic mm-hmm. level. And so there are all kinds of, you know, there are all kinds of proposals for reform mm-hmm. to get Congress working. I'll just give two examples. You know, one is the Hastert rule. I mean, the idea that nothing can get a vote unless a majority of the Republicans endorse it is an abomination. We have to get Congress working. We have to facilitate compromise. And then there's corruption. The fact that groups can give money, large amounts of money, is horrible. I can't believe mm-hmm. that. You know, I can't give a program officer at the National Science Foundation. I can't buy her a cup of coffee. I once tried, and she said, "No, I can't take a cup of coffee because that'll bias me." You know, but if you're a congressman, I can give you lots and lots of money. So, you know, we have to change corruption. We have to change the way Congress engages. I love the proposal. I forget it was from Norm Ornstein, I think, that Congress should be in session for 3 weeks and then off for one, because then they'd hang around on weekends and they might actually meet each other. So there's all kinds of reforms that would make Congress more functional. The media environment is harder. It's hard to change that. But I think we could do a lot to reform Congress.
John, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist and author. His most recent book is The Coddling of the American Mind: How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Our guest host today was Jenna Spinelli, host of the Democracy Works podcast, produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. You can hear more Take Note interviews at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Emily Reddy, WPSU.